Anyway, glad you're all here. We're really excited to continue our Garden to Garden series. And I want to thank Pastors Kristen and Pastor Marcus for leading us through the last couple weeks, all the good things that we've been studying. And we're going to finish Genesis today, which feels insane and slightly miraculous. Because the first time we preached through Genesis back in 2014, it took over a year, I think. So it's only the end, beginning of March. That's not so bad, right? It was just like we only took 2 months, really, with some breaks. So really, I should be congratulated. All right, we're going to get through all of... Thank you, Grace. Well done. Okay, we're going to be in Genesis. Here's why we're going to finish all of Genesis today. We're going to be in all of these chapters. So Genesis 37 through 50, if you're keeping up, we're going to grab the last bit of narrative, and we're not going to cover it all. That's what Monday night is for, so come online or in the room tomorrow night and ask all the questions about all the very difficult things that I'm skipping over tonight, but that we didn't skip over 10 years ago, and we're happy to talk about. So we're not skipping the story of Tamar and Judah. We have talked about it. And we're not skipping the story of Dinah. We've talked about that too. We are going to talk about all those things. But tonight, we're going to zoom in on Joseph so we can finish Garden to Garden before Jesus comes. Okay. So tonight is Joseph, drought, Egypt is coming. And I'll be pulling from Genesis 37 until Genesis chapter 50, and we'll be going through all of that. And assuming that not all of us are incredibly familiar with the story, or maybe we need a refresher, I know I always do, we're going to look at the story a little bit in depth at the very beginning, and we'll talk about some things we can learn from it. So let's pray together, and we'll get started. Jesus, we are grateful for the chance to come together. We're grateful for the opportunity to come together and to study your word, to study your ways, to be with one another, to be in community where we practice discipleship and resistance and resilience and joy in the midst of challenging circumstances. May you tune our ears and our hearts to you as we listen to a story of our brother Joseph who had to do these things as well. And we ask it all in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. I'm going to be reading from the Complete Jewish Bible Translation, which is a translation by Professor David Stern. He was professor at Fuller Theological Seminary, and he also happened to be a Jew who also believed in Jesus. And so he made a translation that is used in a lot of communities, also still like even in Israel, where there's Christian communities that are identifying still as Jewish communities, but also trying to follow Jesus as Messiah. So when we get to this translation, there's going to be some words that I hope you're learning for the first time or the second or the 50th time, and we're just going to try to tune our ears to it. The reason why I'm choosing this translation is because I want to help all of us remember that we're reading into a very ancient text set in a very distant time from ours in a land far, far away, in a galaxy far, far away, and that we are listening in and doing our best to try to understand. So Yaakov, you know him as Jacob. Yaakov continued living in the land where his father had lived as a foreigner in the land of Canaan. Here is the history of Yaakov. When Yosef was 17 years old, he used to pasture the flock with his brothers, even though he was still a boy. Once, everyone who has a 17-year-old knows that's a true statement. 17 and still a boy. Once, when he was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, he had brought a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel, also known as Yaakov or Jacob, loved Yosef the most of all his children. And he was the son of, as because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a long-sleeved robe. Now we're going to stop right here and note, thank you, Pastor Tom, a couple things. Israel loves Joseph best. Now, the Hebrew actually has an emphasis here. It's like, it was he whom his father loved. Now, for those of you who've been following along at home, reading through Genesis, we know that this is not the first time a father has had a favorite, or even a father has been defined as having a son that he loved. So Jacob's favoritism here is maybe it's understandable, right? Joseph's the son of his beloved wife, Rachel. the one he actually worked 14 years for, right? Born after so many years of heartbreak and frustration. But Jacob does know, doesn't he, the heartbreak of one son being loved more than another and the pain it causes between the brothers. Doesn't he know that? He knows what that is between him and his brother Esau. His father knew it between Isaac and Ishmael. And now he's repeating this same pattern. So much so that he decides to outfit the son with a clothing option that indicates and shouts from long distances and far, far away, "This is the one I love the most." So I have 12 sons, right? I have many sons and many, no, Father Abraham. Okay, I have many sons. But this one is going to get a very fancy tunic. Now, we've talked about it as being the amazing Technicolor dream coat. Donny Osmond did a great job of indoctrinating all of us on it a long time ago. But actually, the word in Hebrew does not have anything to do with color. We actually don't know exactly what this coat is. In Hebrew, it's ketonet pasim. Now, ketonet is just the word for tunic or robe or cloak, okay? And so when we talk about, everybody will say it's the coat of many colors. That's how it was initially translated in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint, and later on in the Latin translation of our Bible, the Vulgate. But in the Hebrew, ketonet pasim, keton is just a tunic that's worn by both men and women. The second word is the one we don't know what it means. Does it mean ornamented? Does it mean special? Does it have the connotation of stripes? Has maybe that connotation? It's long-sleeved, some people say, and then ultimately people go, we're going to say it's multicolored. Whatever the case, it was distinctive. They could recognize it from a distance. And we have a plaque from Egypt, from Medinet Habu, which depicts an individual from the general region of Canaan. And that looks pretty fancy, right? It looks good. We don't know exactly what Joseph's was. It was a bit different. The only other time this is mentioned is in the story of 2 Samuel 13 with Tamar having a very unfortunate violation by her brother, and she is also wearing a ketonet pasim. So it was also the robe or the tunic that was being worn by the daughters of the king, of King David. So we are kind of confused. We don't know exactly. When my daughter was taking this class at her school, they had a big conversation about it really being a striped garment. And they asked the kids, think of all the reasons why Joseph is needing to wear ketonet pasim, a striped garment, something striped. And they said, well, let's think about the story. Joseph's going to be promoted in Egypt later, and he'll be like Pharaoh's right-hand guy. And so he's kind of like he's in the military, and military people wear stripes. So maybe that's why he's in a stripe. And then somebody, another kid said, well, you know what? He's going to have to try to sort things out between his brothers, kind of like a referee. Referees wear stripes. Maybe that's why he's wearing a stripe. And another kid said, well, he's going to be imprisoned for a really long time. And prisoners wear stripes. Maybe that's why he's going to have a striped garment. These are all fun ways to think about the Bible, and I encourage you to do so. Ask all the questions. And someday when we get to heaven, we will pull Yaakov and Yosef aside and say, tell us about the ketonet pasim. And they'll say, it was my downfall of my existence. Please don't talk about it anymore. I have deep trauma. So, verse 4, when his brothers saw, they can see that the father loved him more than all the other brothers, they began to hate him and reached the point where they couldn't even talk with him in a peaceful manner. And the root there is shalom. Like, there's no shalom in this family because a father loves one child more than the others and has made that child distinctive. Well, Yosef has a dream, and he tells his brothers, and that made them hate him all the more. Right? So if the tunic wasn't enough, now we're just going to solidify the hatred. He said to them, listen while I tell you this dream of mine. Remember that it said that Yosef was 17 and still a boy. So, you know, maybe he's not reading the room yet. I encourage us all to read the room. We were tying up bundles of wheat in the field when suddenly my bundle got up by itself, stood upright. Your bundles came, gathered around mine, and you all bowed down to me. And his brothers retorted, yeah, you'll certainly be our king. You'll do a great job of bossing us around. Sarcasm in the Bible right there. And they hated him still more for his dreams and for what he said. And then he had a second dream where he told his brothers, here I had another dream. There's the sun and the moon and the 11 stars prostrating themselves before me. And he told his father too, as well as his brothers, but his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream? dream you've had. Do you really expect me, your mother, and your brothers to come and prostrate ourselves before you on the ground?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Why? I think Yaakov might have had a dream too at one point. No? Pastor Marcus talked about it last week. Now, with this, we're just going to interrupt our story and narrative here to say that the way that God is interacting with people over the course of the book of Genesis is now changing. And this marks a very distinctive shift and change into how God is talking with God's people. In the garden, God walked with us in the cool of the evening and had face-to-face conversations, right? He had face-to-face conversations with Cain. Where'd you put your brother? With Noah. Hey, build a big boat. To Abraham, get up and get going, and I will make a covenant with you. To Isaac, I will make a covenant with you. To Jacob, who gets covenant language but also gets that weird dream at Beth-El, at the house of God, Beth-El. Now, interestingly now, from this point forward, things shift. Joseph will never receive a divine revelation or communication, at least one that's not recorded for us. He does not build an altar. He doesn't make a covenant. He doesn't hear into that. He does not have any association with a religious center. God never openly and directly intervenes in Joseph's life. Which I know you're going to think, well, that's weird because I see God all over the story. And yes, but it's a little bit different. He doesn't say to Joseph, "Lech lecha, get up and get going. Abraham, make a path. Here's what you're going to do," right? Instead, with Joseph, it's a little bit different. Thus, Joseph is not going to be included among our patriarchs. We say Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, or Israel, but we don't say, and Joseph. The Jewish tradition restricts that category to just Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the four mothers, Rachel and Leah included. From this point forward, as people who are readers and listeners to the text, we're going to start to see God in the after. And this is what Pastor Marcus was talking with us about last week. Jacob said, "Surely God is in this place, and I did not know it." Now, Jacob had already been there. He'd spent a whole night there, right? Moses is going to go to the burning bush, and he's going to have just been walking around and hanging out. And all of a sudden, he sees a bush that's like on fire but not consumed, and he kind of gets forward. And then God says, "Hey, the place where you're standing is holy ground." And then he takes off his shoes. Moses will also want to talk to God and say, "Let me see you face to face." And God's like, "You can't handle my face. You can handle my after." And so he pushes Moses into the rock and passes by him, and Moses can see God's after. So a lot of our story and our narrative at this point is going to be people understanding their experience in history and understanding God's divine intervention into that experience from the after. And isn't that true for most of us too, right? How does that work for you in your life? Maybe some of us, and please give me a call and tell me the story. It's fantastic. Some of us have had those moments where God showed up in the moment and spoke directly, and you heard something. And I've had a couple of those. But a lot of times I see God in the after. It's after the traumatic event, after the beautiful event, after the great thing, the difficult thing, the hard thing, and in community where I can look back and go, "Oh, God was here. God was at work. God was doing something beautiful." And this is the story that Israel is also going to be able to tell. Now, dreams throughout the ancient Near East are recognized as divine experiences. Like, if you have a dream, this is a experience. We have to, you know, consult the powers that be. There is a Babylonian cuneiform tablet that's used to assist in assigning meaning to dreams. So we know this is not the only one. From the ancient Near East, we have tablets that are like, "Hey, did you have a weird dream? Here's how we figure it out. Here's how we're going to talk to the gods. Here's how we're going to like read the tea leaves or the liver or whatever it is in order to try to determine what is the meaning behind the dream that you had." But in the Hebrew Bible, God is the source of the dreams, even though God does not feature prominently in the visions. Think of the two dreams Joseph just had. They're about him and his brothers. They're not about God. He's not having a revelation about God. Now, remember Jacob with Bethel, he has this incredible vision of like the angels of God ascending and descending, and God says, "I am the God of your fathers, of Abraham and of Isaac." And here I am also now the God of you, right? And then remember that Jacob's going to have that crazy, weird experience wrestling with a man. No, it's God. What is it? And he won't let that thing go until he gets that blessing. It's a real experience with God. But here God is giving dreams to Jacob, to Joseph. Now, Joseph's dreams and Pharaoh's dreams later are not pure encounters with God like that Jacob Bethel thing. They're now symbolic and they require interpretation. But interestingly, there is no record of an Israelite ever needing the skill of an interpreter to understand their dream. In fact, Israelites are the ones that are often serving as interpreters, as Joseph will do for Pharaoh and as Daniel will do for King Nebuchadnezzar. So, back to our story. Here we go. Jacob, Israel, is going to tell Joseph, who's been kept back to hang out in his fancy tunic, go check on your brothers. So after all this, when his brothers had gone to pasture their father's sheep in Shechem, Israel asked Yosef, "Aren't your brothers pasturing the sheep in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he answered, "Here I am." That's funny, isn't it? He like answers, "Here I am," after the whole conversation's already occurred. And he said to him, "Okay, go now and see whether things are going well with your brothers and with the sheep and bring word back to me." So he sent him away from the Hebron Valley and went to Shechem. Now, Hebron is down just south of Bethlehem, and he's going to go up what we refer to as the patriarchal ridge route. We call it that because the patriarchs walk on it, and it's a ridge. It's the easiest way to go back north and south. And so the patriarchs are going to hang out on that road a lot. They love it. They love this ridge route. And so they're going to go up north past Bethel and past into like the central portion of what we call Samaria. Later on, we'll call it that in our Hebrew Bible, into Shechem. And for those of you who are paying attention, Shechem was the site of the really horrific incident with Dinah. So we know that they're in an area of town that's not great, that donkeys are in charge of. That's what the word Hamor means. And it means in the King James literal version sense of that those are where the people, the donkeys live that do terrible things to our daughters. So maybe that's why Jacob's concerned about his sons. They're very far north. He sent him away from the Hebron Valley, went to Shechem, and there Yosef's going to find a man wandering around in the countryside. Now, I just want to note really quickly as we go back. This means, why are they that far north? They're quite a bit far from home and in an area and a region that's not friendly. Why are they that far north? Well, we're going to take on your great biblical geographer. Are you ready? Get all your hats on and say, okay, the Bible wants me to know these details. It's not just saying it for no reason. It's telling me that they went, you know, from LA to San Luis Obispo, right? And so I would need to know that information and have a context for it. And hopefully a lot of us already just had pictures pop in our head, right? I sent them all the way to this place, right? There's no water. And as a person who spent a lot of time in the land and as like a has studied a lot of historical geography, the moment I see that they're going from Hebron up to Shechem, I'm like, they're looking for green pastures. It's starting to tell me about how there's not enough water in the land or maybe what time of year it is. So he goes a long journey. He walks. He gets up to this beautiful region. This is the Shechem Valley right there. And he finds this man, and the man asks him, "What are you looking for?" "I'm looking for my brothers," he answered. "Tell me, please, where are they pasturing the sheep?" Random dude just out there, and you're like, "Could you tell me where my brothers are?" And the man said, "Oh, I know this information. They've left here because I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" And Yosef went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Here are modernly pictures of shepherds there in a field in the valley of Dothan. It's nice, isn't it? There's some green around. They're obviously in a field that's already been harvested because you're not going to let shepherds take their flock out there and eat your wheat, right? That's not going to happen. So we know again about what time of year it has to be. They're out there in those fields. And then beautiful Tel Dothan and the Dothan Valley. So you can see already, if I started to show you pictures of Hebron, it's very brown, it's cliffs, it's rocky, it's difficult shepherding area, but you can manage it. It's a good place. But if I said, "Hey, do you want to go shepherd in like green and lush and wet?" You'd be like, "Yes, please. Thank you very much." In the country of Canaan, of Israel, north is wet, south is dry, high is wet, low is dry, west is wet, east is dry. They're going north and heading west and trying to get high because they're looking for some water. The brothers spot him in the distance, It's the cloak. And before he's arrived where they were, they had already decided to kill this guy. And they say to each other, look, this dreamer's coming, so come now, let's kill him, throw him into one of these water cisterns here, and then we'll say some wild animal devoured him, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams. And the Brick Testament has a very good rendition of all this conversation. But when Reuven heard this, he saved them. He saved him from being destroyed by them. He said, we shouldn't take his life. And then he says this great line, don't shed blood. It's from Genesis 9. It's the command that is happening after the flood and the receding of the waters and how they are to not, this Noahide covenant that's right there, don't shed blood. Reuven added, throw him into this cistern here in the wilds, but don't lay hands on him yourself. And he intended to rescue him from them later and restore him to his father. So it was that when Yosef arrived to be with his brothers, they stripped off his robe, the long-sleeved robe he was wearing, and took him and threw him into the cistern. And then the text tells us what we already know, that the cistern was empty and it didn't have any water in it. So this is bad news, right? Like if you have holes dug into the ground, they're supposed to be holding water, and you're north and west and trying to get high and there's no water, I hear the text, the author of Genesis shouting, famine is coming. Famine is coming. You're going to have to leave here. This land cannot sustain life. And right here, I'm like, oh, Joseph's got to go to Egypt. And the author of Genesis wants you to know that. When the Bible speaks of famine, by the way, we have to realize it's not just a shortage of food or water. It's a shortage of everything that is necessary for life. A drought means that there's no agriculture for both humans and animals. As the animals go hungry and thirsty, their ability to procreate and feed their own young is also lost. Within just one or two seasons of drought, families will lose between 20 to 40% of their flock. With no animals left to provide dairy or meat or fleece or hair or clothing or blankets or tents, the people suffer from thirst and hunger and cold. Famine doesn't mean I'm hungry and I don't get to eat my favorite things. Famine means you're dying and your people will die. Now, the brothers have tossed this good brother in, and they are going to sit down and eat, because that's what you can do when you've tossed your brother into an empty cistern. Now, it'll tell us later on in the text that Joseph's actually crying out. Like, when the brothers will get to Egypt and finally confront Joseph, and they're like, we're being punished because, remember, we didn't listen to our brother's cries. So here, they're eating, and Yosef's clearly going, little bit of help here. How you gonna hand me any food? Are you gonna get me out? As they looked up, though, they're sitting down to eat. They look up, they see in front of them a caravan of Ishmaelites, Yishmaelim, coming from Gilad, their camels loaded with aromatic gum, healing resin, and opium on their way down to Egypt. Now, we know where they are, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, is right on this incredibly beautiful trade route in the Fertile Crescent. So it's not surprising that where they are in Dothan, that people are going to be passing by. For sure they're passing by. This is a very good trade route. So Yehuda says to his brothers, what advantage is it to us if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? A quote of Genesis 4:8 with the story of Cain and Abel. Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelim instead of putting him to death with our own hands. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh. Let's just sell him into slavery, right? It's no problem. His brothers paid attention to him, and with that, so when the Midianites, merchants passed by, they drew and lifted Yosef up out of the cistern and sold him for half a pound of silver shekels to the Ishmaelim, who took Yosef on to Egypt. Now, they're trading in humans, in people. This was common to the day. And this is the common price given. And this trade route was known for this. So when they see these folks coming, it's not like a brand new idea is just occurring to them. Hey, maybe I wonder if they might take our brother off our hands. They know human trafficking happens. They see people doing it all the time. They know they're on that trade route. They see the traders coming, and they know they can very easily make a profit off their brother without having to have the blood on their own hands. So Joseph is betrayed into Egypt, and in that trade route right there, he's pulled down towards Egypt. The Midianites grab him, they pull him out of the well, and they take him on his way. Reuven returns to the cistern. Upon seeing that Yosef wasn't in it, he tears his clothes in mourning, which is still a universal symbol amongst Jews who are mourning, to rip, to rend a garment. He tears his clothes in mourning. He returns to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I go now?" And they took Yosef's robe, killed a male goat, dipped the robe in the blood, and they sent the long-sleeved robe and brought it to their father. And look at this. This is all they have to say. "Hey, we found this. Do you know if it's your son's robe or not? Not our brother, your son. Look, I just found this robe." Yaakov recognizes it, cries, "It's my son's robe. Some wild animal has torn Yosef in pieces and eaten him." They didn't even have to tell the lie. They let Yaakov come up with it all by himself. Yaakov tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth around his waist, mourns for his son for many days, and though all his sons and daughters tried to comfort him, he refused all consolation, saying, I will go down to my grave to my son mourning. And his father wept for him. Now, what was it that convinced him that Yosef was dead? What was it? The robe. Don't you think there's some sort of poetic justice in this? The rabbis thought so. There's a phrase in Hebrew, midah keneged midah. It means measure for measure. Jesus says it too. Measure for measure will be added unto you. Do you remember that Jacob, Yaakov, once deceived his father? How did he do that? With a garment, a hairy robed garment. He deceived his own father, and now he, measure for measure, he is reaping what he sowed, and now his own sons are deceiving him with a garment too. Bummer, man. Careful there. All right. The story continues that in Egypt, the Midianim sold Yosef to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, a captain of the guard. Yosef was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain's guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelim who had brought him there. Verse 2, ready? Adonai was with Yosef. He became wealthy while he was in the household of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw how Adonai was with him, that Adonai prospered everything he did, and Yosef pleased him as he served him, and his master appointed him manager of his household, and he entrusted all his possessions to Yosef. This is how the genitive narrative turns with our encounters with God. We start to see that God is with people or not with people. And so what happens here in this moment is that the things that Yosef is at work doing are prospering. Now, from the time he appointed him manager of his household and all his possessions, Adonai blessed the Egyptian's household for Yosef's sake. Adonai's blessing was on all he owned, whether it was in the house or in the field. And so he left all his possessions in Yosef's care. And because he had him, he paid no attention to his affairs except for the food he ate. That must be nice, right? Nothing to worry about. You just have to worry about your meals. Here's my favorite line. Ready? Now, Yosef was well-built and handsome. This is a good-looking dude. And in time, the day came when his master's wife took a look at Yosef and said, "Hey, sleep with me." And he refused, saying to his master's wife, "Look, because my master has me, he doesn't know what's going on in this house." It's like terrible foreshadowing. "And he has put all his possessions in my charge. In this house, I am his equal. He hasn't withheld anything from me except yourself, because you're his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" So it's interesting that Yosef has this idea of like ethics and morality that must be kept. But she kept pressing him day after day. Nevertheless, he didn't listen to her, and he refused to sleep with her or even be with her. However, one day when he went into the house to do his work and none of the men living in the house was there indoors, she grabbed him by his robe and said, "Sleep with me." But he fled, leaving his robe in her hand, and got himself outside. A robe is going to be this brother's undoing again. And so when he saw that he had left his robe in her hand and had escaped, she called the men of her house and said, "Look at this. My husband brought in a Hebrew to make fools of us." Abram was the first person referred to as a Hebrew, and now we have another. "He came in and wanted to sleep with me, but I yelled loudly. And then he heard me yelling like that. He left his robe with me and ran out." She put the robe aside until his master came home. And then she said, "This Hebrew slave you brought us came in to make a fool of me. But when I yelled out, he left his robe with me and fled outside. And when his master heard what his wife had said and showed him, 'Here's what your slave did to me,' he became furious. And Yosef's master took him and put him in prison in the place where the king's prisoners were kept. And there he was in prison." It's a bad day. A bad day in the Brick Testament. But Adonai was with Yosef. showing him grace and giving him favor in the sight of the prison warden. And the prison warden made Yosef supervisor. He just keeps getting responsibility, man. I bet, could you not put me in charge anymore? Supervisor of all the prisoners in the prison. So whatever they did, he was in charge of it. And the prison warden paid no attention to anything Yosef did because Adonai was with him. And whatever he did, Adonai prospered. Insert cupbearer and baker. Now they're going to have a terrible dream one night. And after they have that dream, they don't know what it means. They're trying to figure it out. We've each had a dream, but there's no one there to interpret it for us. Well, Joseph's an expert at dreams. So one night, they both had these dreams, each dream with its own meaning. Yosef came to them in the morning, saw they looked sad, depressed, and he said, "Hey, why are you looking so sad today?" And then, "We had a dream, but there's no one around to interpret it." And Yosef said to them, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please." Very fascinating encounter. So they do. They let Yosef know what it is that they have studied, and Yosef properly interprets both dreams from the cupbearer and the baker. I'm not going to go into it. You can go and read it all. Basically, it's a good idea, good day for the cupbearer and a bad day for the baker. And Joseph's interpretations came true at Pharaoh's birthday party, but the cupbearer forgot about Joseph. 2 years later. I thought Adonai was with Yosef in all that he did and all that he prospered. Wouldn't you have a note at this point? I'm still here. I'm still being faithful. I'm still being placed in charge of everything. Why you gotta wait 2 years? Why I gotta be in prison for 2 years? 2 years later, Pharaoh has a dream. And in the morning after this dream that he has, he finds himself so upset that he summons all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh tells them his dreams, but no one can interpret them for him. And then the chief cupbearer says to Pharaoh, "Oh, this reminds me of something where I am at fault. I forgot a dude. He's still there in prison. It took you 2 years to remember that guy?" And then Pharaoh summons Yosef, and they bring him out quickly out of the dungeon. He shaves himself, he cleans his clothes, he comes into Pharaoh, and he says, "You're going to have 7 years of plenty, and then you're going to have 7 years of famine. That thing I saw happening in Canaan is going to start to hit Egypt, even though Egypt has the Nile, even though in Egypt we just have to drag our foot in the mud, and the water fills in, and the crops and the plenty are there. So you better get prepared." And Pharaoh's like, "That seems like a good idea." And Pharaoh says to his officials, "Can we find anybody else like him? The Spirit of God lives in him." So Pharaoh says to Yosef, "Since God's shown you all this and there's no one as discerning and wise as you, you will be in charge of my household and all my people will be ruled by what you say. Only when I rule from my throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Yosef, "Here I place you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand, put it on Yosef's hand, had him clothed in fine linen with a gold chain around his neck, had him ride in his second best chariot, not the first, just the second. And then they cried before him, "Bow down," and thus he placed him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said to Yosef, "I, Pharaoh, decree that without your approval, no one is to raise his hand or his foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Yosef by his name, Tzafnat Paneh, and gave him as his wife, Osnat Asenath, which, by the way, is, yes, our African matriarch in our story. She's incredible, and she's going to have two, she'll be the mother of two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On. And then Yosef went out throughout all the land of Egypt. Okay, now that you're up to speed, Joseph, drought, Egypt is coming. So this Joseph story in our Bible is going to initiate the chain of events that leads to our descent to Egypt as the Israelites. It's going to be the prelude to the drama of oppression and redemption for all of Exodus, and it's going to constitute the overriding motif of all biblical theology, which is that there are Egypts, but that God can redeem. And this story, this narrative, the events that are going to be happening because we're going to be enslaved in Egypt for hundreds of years, but that God is going to rescue and redeem and set free. This event, all of this, this is all going to be how we read our Gospels, how we read the Apostle Paul, how we read the rest of the epistles, how we read the rest of our narrative, which is that, yes, Egypt happens, but God cares about oppression, and God cares and has promised and will redeem. This is our story. Now, when we start to read these stories in Genesis, it's very easy to get locked in to these personalities, especially Joseph, because he gets described the most. Even though, by the way, he's not going to have his own tribal allotment in the land. It's going to be given, it'll be a doubling between his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, but we don't have a tribe of Joseph. And also, by the way, ultimately, who are we going to care most about? What's the line that we care most about when we get to Jesus? He must be of the line of David, which is of the line of Judah, which has nothing to do with Joseph. And yet we have Genesis 37 through 50, pretty much nearly all of it, dedicated to this story of Joseph. So it's very easy for us to go, okay, how can I grow up to be like Joseph? If only when I get imprisoned or stuck into some sort of god-awful governmental system where I have to like bow down to crazy persons, if I can just be there and be faithful, God will bless the works of my hands and I will be there and God will be with me. And then all of a sudden the Pharaoh will be like, hey, you know what? You're the right person to put in charge. Let me just give you all the keys. If only we could see that working still in our day, right? So it's really easy for us to go, okay, well, what did Joseph do right? Well, Joseph could interpret dreams. I'll go take a class on dream interpretation, and then I'm going to take another class. I mean, we try to control or become like Joseph, or we'll try to become like Rachel, or we'll try to become like Moses. It's okay to try to become like Jesus. That's actually commanded. Whoever claims to him must walk as Jesus walked. Imitate me as I imitate Christ, Paul says. But what we're looking at here in our narrative is that God is the central character of our story. And if we start to read this story looking for how God is at work in the midst of challenging circumstances, in the midst of disappointing behaviors from siblings, then we can start to see where God is in our afters. Joseph's experience is the culmination of a series of episodes set in motion by causes that were often temporal, petty, sordid, and mundane. A father's favoritism, he likes to tattle, sibling jealousies, egotistic boyish dreams, all of these elements of a family situation that culminates in explosive tragedy, but God is working through it all. So here's the good news, Spark, you ready? If you thought you had to have, you know, parents that were really great spiritual leaders and had all their stuff together, or siblings that never quarreled, or children that never quarreled, or that you had to do every single thing right in order to get blessed by God, the book of Genesis is here to tell you, no, 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 we are a hot mess. We're going to tell you that we're a hot mess from the beginning. And by the way, if you and I were writing our own story and we're going to pass it down from generation to generation, would you talk about the time when one of the heads of the tribe, like Judah, you know, slept with his daughter-in-law and then didn't like own that for a long time, and then his son, I mean, like really, like, are you going to tell the story? No, these are pages I would pull out of my family book, right? I'd be like, and then we moved here, and then this person just wasn't around anymore, not because we sold them into slavery. Like, I mean, I would not broadcast our family's dirty laundry, but the Bible does it because God works through it all. That's the point. That's what we're supposed to learn. That God's guiding hand is in seemingly haphazard events. Joseph's lost, and he meets a guy who knows exactly where his brothers are. The caravan of traders happened to be going to Egypt. The Lord's with Joseph in Potiphar's house and also in prison. The name of God comes readily to Joseph's lips at critical moments when confronted by Potiphar's wife, when he interprets dreams, when he tests his brothers later. Joseph is ready to be in this moment with God, but God is at work in these moments with Joseph. Not because Joseph's great, but because God is good. And because God is keeping God's covenantal promises to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, in spite of them. Now, the other thing I think Genesis wants us to know, that at the very beginning of Genesis, do you remember what happens? One brother's killed another, but by the end, brothers are reconciled. So as we continue in our Joseph story here, we know at the very beginning in Genesis, the first thing that happens is Cain kills Abel. And we're to see every murder from this point forward as fratricide, as a brother taking the life of a brother. And the blood cries out from the ground, and this is being echoed throughout our Joseph story. But by the end of Genesis, Joseph's brothers have found themselves in deep need of food because there's famine in the land. And so a series of very crazy events, and they get sent back down to Egypt by Jacob, and then they try to get some food, and then Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize Joseph, and go read it all. I'm not going to cover it all today. But ultimately, they realize that Joseph is the one in charge of Egypt, that Joseph has been there in charge this whole time, that he's not killed, that he's risen in the ranks. And by the time we get to Genesis 45, verses 7 and 8, Joseph says, God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival on earth and to save your lives in an extraordinary deliverance. So it was not you who sent me here, but it was God. This revelation, I am Joseph, I am your brother, the one you sold into slavery, I think he should mention that, is my father still alive, right? He's sitting there saying, this was the work of God. And those brothers come back into place and are reconciled with him. After Jacob, Yaakov, Israel dies, the brothers are worried. They're like, oh, I think Joseph was only being nice to us because dad was still around. Now he's going to hate us and pay us back in full for the suffering he caused us. They send a message to Yosef and they said, your father said this before he died. Let's just put words into dad's mouth. Say to Yosef, I beg now, please forgive your brother's crime and wickedness in doing your harm. So now we beg you, forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father. And his brothers came to and prostrated themselves before them, and here they are bowing down. And they said, here we are your slaves. But Yosef says what? Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You meant to do me harm, but God meant it for good, so that it would come about as it is today, with many people's lives being saved. So don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And in this way, he comforted them, speaking kindly to them. The book of Genesis is about reconciliation. And if you want to know, reconciliation is one of our core five values here at Spark. And you can go and read all about it. That we have been reconciled through Christ, that we have been given the ministry of reconciliation. But the reason why this is one of our core values is because of those verses in the New Testament, also because of what we see in Genesis. And the Genesis opens with Cain killing Abel. But then guess what? Even as Isaac and Ishmael have this conflict and problem, and Ishmael and Hagar have been sent out and all of this pain, they both show up together to bury their dad. That conflict between brothers has this piece of reconciliation by the end. Jacob, who stole Esau's birthright, to be fair, he sold it for a bit of stew, they are reconciled in the end. And when Jacob finally meets Esau again and they see each other face to face, and Esau's been given territory and land, and Jacob's descendants are still going to have to go to Egypt to fulfill the covenant. When they meet, and Jacob's freaked out because Esau has every right to take revenge. They meet, they reconcile, and Jacob says to Esau, just seeing your face has been like seeing the face of God. These brothers get reconciled in the end. And Joseph and his brothers are reconciled in the end. The story of Genesis is to tell us that God is the central character of our story, and that when we are in families and systems and empires where there's strife and difficulty and pain, God is about God's work and God's business through our dysfunction, through our craziness, and God will bring reconciliation in the end. In fact, Psalm 133 has this beautiful hint how good and pleasant it is for brothers to live, to dwell, to sit together in harmony. It is like fragrant oil over the beard. It runs over the beard of Aaron and flows down on the collar of his robes. It's like the dew of Hermon, the dew of heaven, that settles on the mountains of Zion, all the way down to Jerusalem. For it is there that Adonai ordained the blessing of everlasting life. The psalmist declares that when brothers are dwelling together, when we come back together and we're with one another, it's like the dew of Hermon has landed on Jerusalem. And if you want to just search the word dew, it pops up several times in our Genesis narrative to talk about a blessing. And so we're seeing here that the psalmist is like, oh yeah, when brothers are reconciled, it's like dew. Couple last little bits. Friends, Joseph influences empire. And what we find out in this moment is that influence can win over authoritarianism. And wherever we are, in whatever systems we're in, God is the central character of our story, and we can still have influence. Joseph chooses integrity over personal gain. He is given many opportunity to take something that's not his, and he chooses integrity and ethics over it. So friends, Let's stay faithful to the way of Jesus. There will be many opportunities in our current situation to benefit from systems of oppression. People are doing so now. Let's stay faithful to the way of Jesus. Joseph does teach us that integrity is greater than opportunity, and that faithful persistence is greater than our circumstances. Faithful persistence is greater than our circumstances. And we can find these lessons of resiliency and lessons of hope throughout the Bible, throughout this story, that God is faithful after, you know, somebody's forgotten to mention that we did this good thing at work for over 2 years and then we come to somebody's mind. That God is with us in these difficult circumstances, that God is with us as we're being thrown into empty cisterns, that God is with us as we are in the middle of sibling strife, and that God is about the business of siblings being reconciled. And I can think many Christian sisters and brothers right now who are in need of deep reconciliation. And I know that there's many that I don't often want to reach out to. But the story of Genesis tells me that God is at work and that my faithful persistence is greater than these circumstances, that I will continue to pursue the way of Jesus and continue to find a way to reconcile and to love. And so lastly, we'll read the words of Winston Churchill in 1941. Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelmingly might of the enemy. Like Egypt, still Egypt, y'all. Do not let us speak of darker days. Let us speak rather of sterner days. These are not dark days. These are great days. The greatest days of our country has ever lived, and we must all thank God that we've been allowed, each of us according to our stations, to play a part in making these days memorable in the history of our race. You know, he said this under very difficult circumstances. And I just keep thinking about how God's job is to be in charge of everything. God's the central character of my story. And it's my job to not give up. And to keep following Jesus, to keep living with integrity and ethics and the way of Christ, no matter what the powers are declaring or pushing. The Christians in the early days of the Roman Empire, they stood out because they only had one king, only one Lord, and that was Jesus Christ. And here in this community, I am grateful that together we are pursuing the way and the person of Jesus. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." Every week we come to this table, this humble table, where Christ invites all and says, "This is what the kingdom looks like." All are welcome at this table. Hungry, thirsty, strangers, weak, sick, all. We are all welcome at this table. And at this table we can find shalom and reconciliation with Christ and reconciliation with one another. So come to the table.